I mean, we did the premise. They fight and then they go to the moon. Keyframes, broadcast.
Keyframes.
Hello and welcome to Keyframes.
Keyframes.
Hello and welcome to Keyframes podcast. Is this an in-between? It's a podcast about anime regardless. I'm your host, Ben Halliburton. With me today is Duncan.
Hey there.
And Jeff.
Yellow.
And if you've ever watched the show that we just were making fun of the OP from, you know that we are talking about Turn A Gundam today. Specifically the first 26 episodes. There's not really a middle point, but the nukes kind of provide it. So yeah. We'll go ahead and take that. I think we can just start out with a talk of vaguely what it's about. Y'all can give your reactions. I can respond as someone who has, as I said, now watched the show 4 times, I guess.
Fully internalized.
It's like when I was really into Baldur's Gate 2, and I just played all of Baldur's Gate 2 like 3 times in a row as a as a teen, and that's like 300 hours of my life. This is a bit more elevated, though, and I don't want to denigrate Baldur's Gate 2. Anyway, Turn A Gundam was meant to be the kind of 20-year anniversary Gundam. It self-consciously separates itself from any of the previous timelines, although it references almost all of them heavily. And it figures a Edwardian turn of last century world being invaded by high-tech humans from the moon who fled a mysterious event thousands of years ago. And it's a show about land, and it's a show about identity. And it's a show about force and justice. And yeah, I love it. I already explained why a few episodes ago. So who wants to give me their reactions?
Well, I've been threatening to watch the show for years now at this point. I've owned the DVDs for quite some time. And I'm fairly certain.
Quite rare DVDs.
Yeah. So. Well, and now I don't feel so bad about them still having the shrink wrap on them. and yeah, I just happened to have. Across the versions that had been previously mentioned that are completely legitimate and hopefully will still exist by the time I finish the series.
Please don't take them down.
And yeah, it's just a solid Gundam that does not fall into the really repetitive nature that especially the old style Gundams, where it is unselfconsciously itself and will frequently just turn into the look how cool the Gundam is by having it like zip pie 20 robots and having them all explode and everybody goes whoa, whereas Turn A hangs on to what almost every series starts as a very small scale, grounded, high stakes, high tension like power play with like very large characters who are bouncing off each other in interesting ways. The sort of self-consciously low-tech setting of Turn A really allows it to sort of stay in that mode for much, much longer. I've only watched the first 26 episodes so far. I don't know if it's going to last, but it's lasted longer than like, you know, the 4 or 5 episodes that it typically does.
The low tech aspect and the way that land continues to matter. I know I already said that's one of the themes, but like as someone who has watched a lot of Tomino, a lot of both Gundam and non-Gundam Tomino, there's always an inflection point similar to when technology stops mattering because someone has unlocked their new type and now can just like kill anybody in any circumstance. There's a point in Brain Powered or Aura Battler Dunbeam where like Tomino stops wanting to deal with the realities of collateral damage and positional warfare and moves the entire setting either into space
or over the ocean.
Mm. And Turn A, even when it does go into space, like the parts of space that we can exist in are small and few, and it never stops being a crowded show where like there are just people around. Even as they're moving south, I feel like in a different show, in the show he made immediately before, Turn A brain powered, like he'd move out over the ocean so he can focus on the characters and their dramas and not have to worry about, you know, like a farmer needing their cow moved or whatever. But in Turn A, they moved out of the Sun Belt, and immediately what they encounter is not desert, even though that's the aesthetic. They encounter like this Mexican coded village having a harvest festival, and they run into the same characters there. And so there's a certain desire not to move past the premise that I think is very rare in Tomino, at least as I've examined. I need to probably watch the 79 series now. I don't relish it because I don't usually take to 50 or 60 episode shows, but this is the exception. But yes, sticking through it, the same characters, them having to kind of modify their identity as this world starts changing very rapidly, and not just for the like 19th century Earthlings, but the Moon Race, where we find out that these are all volunteers, many of whom have very incomplete ideas about warfare and like what their job is and what their objectives are on Earth. And everyone just kind of has to like grow or perish. And it's interesting to see that happen. And it continues throughout.
We're watching this because this is your favorite show. And like,
as of now.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, I think I've had arguments with Andy over whether I'm influenced by my expectations going into shows a fair few times. I think I tend to be harsher on things which I have high expectations for, really, because
really, Duncan,
I'm like, oh, I love this key art, but and then it doesn't live up to my expectations, and I'm like, don't like this little lovable rom-com, and then the other people will be like, oh, this is marvelous. But in this case, I just think this is fully lived up to your billing, which is always a extremely pleasant surprise, right? Like someone's hyping something up and it is genuinely great. I think, like, as you say, it definitely exists on two planes. It is both a hyper competent show which does battle of the week for a good portion of its runtime, and it also is dealing with actual themes and has a consistency to it, which is so often the bane of the giant robo genre, where it's like, okay, we have our big themes, but those themes are getting in the way of our kick-ass action, so out the window they go. Mm-hmm. And I don't really feel there was a moment where that happened in here.
Yeah.
I also wonder if the way I've chosen to watch this has influenced me. I can tell anyone listening to this that if you want to feel nice and relaxed, like, you should take two episodes of Gundam just before bed, and you'll feel nicely chilled out. It's a natural high.
I did two episodes before work for 2 weeks, and there was times I wish I had, you know, I could use that time for other things based on my schedule, but it was always just, it's a nice show. Lauren's a good kid. Deanna and Kiel are the best Prince and Pauper related story ever in my book. Specifically because there's no lesson teaching people that they, you know, belong in their place. Like, Kiel is a better Deanna than Deanna. Ultimately, Deanna is a better Kiel than Kiel. And they, Duncan and I can disagree, but they kind of get their happy endings choosing to be the other person. But also by the end of the movie, the end of the show, there's not really a terrible amount of attention being paid to like which one is which. They're both. And it's nice to hang out with them. All the smaller characters like Sid, the archaeologist, and Colonel Michael, the leader of the militia, and his moron second in command, Lieutenant Yanny.
Before we move too far off this, I just want to say I'm so glad they didn't force in some lore that there's actually some relationship between Kielheim and Deanna. Like, yeah, they don't share any blood. It's just a freaky coincidence, and that's just how the universe rolls. And I'm just like,
I think the first person to comment on it is Teta, and she's just like, wow, they really look alike. And that's all. No one's ever like, oh, they're genetic reincarnations of the ancestral Moon Queen and the Klaxosaur race below the Earth. That's, yeah.
Well, Teta was adjacent to the most jarring example of two people looking the same and definitely not be, and well, yeah, good old Will Game, who we will dunk on profusely at some point this episode. So yeah,
have show Will Game.
on the topic of themes, because you know it is a Tomino show, we have seen how Tomino acts both in interviews and in the other shows that he makes, and I wonder how much credit we should really be giving him for how, like, I genuinely believe he is a genius.
Always a good way to begin a sentence is like, I believe he's a genius, but...
Yeah. Like, he's the kind of savant who will, you know, find a ninth grade textbook, like math textbook, and reinvent calculus from first principles. Like, I think he discovered, like, a theory of mind for women and accidentally made the most, like, thematically interesting Gundam of all time.
No, I agree. Like, I am at this point, especially... Listeners, I haven't talked much. I mean, I have talked a lot about Brain Power, and I'm sure my hosts are dead sick of it. But that's a show where Tomino watched Gundam, and he's like, oh, people are interested in misogyny and hating your parents. I guess I can do that. And, like, him deliberately trying to, like – I don't know. There's the screen cap of the character played by Sochi's voice actor in Brain Power, and it's talking about the, like, world-destroying apocalypse thing, and she says, they say it has the face of a woman and it will destroy the Earth, and it's just like, okay, very beginning, that sort of stuff. Not to mention the whole infamous, like, a bullet for instead of a Christmas present, and, like, I'm going to get revenge on women and my mother. But in Turn A, the very next thing he made, he had two characters who are identical, and he had to think about what makes them different despite being identical. And I think he just similar to how, like, the episode where they're, like, fencing off land and farmers want to leave and the military won't let them leave, just, like, stumbles backwards into some, like, settler imperialism stuff amazingly. He just backed himself into, like, making two interesting women because he had to explain to himself why these two women who look and sound and in many ways act the same, like, what makes them different. And then we also have Sochi, who is much more of a typical Tomino character, but also because there's Kill and Deanna as the two female leads of the show, Sochi being just the most irredeemable brat little sister. No offense, Duncan.
Certainly redeemable. It's very redeemable.
But yeah, he's
maximum redeemability.
He forces, because he grounds it in real history and is not allowed to build a fantastical space of near future or distant future politics and society, he backs himself into some very interesting and I would say surprisingly progressive ideas about women and about, you know, technology and power and, again, land. Pyramid Inu, I mentioned this, I think, talks about how there's this inflection point near the turn of the millennium where Tomino stops thinking about space as a promise and starts thinking about it as a void, as the pit. And there might be interesting things at the bottom of the pit, but once you've left, once you're in it, you're in it. You can't return to Earth. Space is cold and deadly and empty and barren. And Earth is the cradle, and Earth is where humanity belongs to some extent. And so Turn A being at that inflection point means he really thinks, like, there's this advanced society on the moon, and there's all these vignettes with the tertiary characters where they're like, oh, Earth has germs, and Earth has all this, like, gross, weird shit, and everyone on Earth is crazy. But also, like, the moon people have to return to the Earth. Like, there is no future for humanity on the moon. Even when they return to the moon, it's this sterile Byzantine court full of, like, death and bullshit and doomsday machines that no one can control. And it, I don't know. So it's just really fascinating that, like, those monkeys wrote a Shakespeare play, and it's really incredible to watch.
First time Kiel and Deanna swap places, like, they're just in this airship going over the plains, and Deanna's looking out, and she's surprised at the variety of the landscape and how that it's changing, and that almost gives up the gig. Like, people almost twig that why is Kiel Heim surprised at how beautiful the landscape is, and Kiel, as Deanna turns to her and goes, oh, didn't you tell me that the Earth is always changing? And then Deanna, as Kiel turns back and goes, well, yes, just as I was telling you, the moon never changes.
Mm-hmm.
That idea of they are literally trying to keep themselves in stasis.
Yes, I was going to bring up that point. Exactly, yeah. It's interesting that the ultimate villain in the show is the guy in charge of keeping everyone in stasis, manipulating the military against just the people who want to live and farm and grow food and the like. I do think, in another example of something that's relatively rare, I haven't watched a lot of other Gundam. I've watched 8th MS Team, War in the Pocket, a couple other shorter shows. I just need to get into longer shows with Gundam.
You like the spin-offs rather than the mainline.
But yeah, and Turn A Gundam is marvelously self-contained. There are cool references, especially all the robots they dig up and use ad hoc. But it is something you can watch incredibly alone. But I don't know how often in Gundam there are factions within government that are so, like, usually it's very personless factions, as I understand it, having watched a bit of 79 through G Quux's weird whatever. But like, instead of personless factions, there's like these, you know, Deanna Counter is the kind of progressive, like, forward thinking, and then
ideological things is what you're thinking about.
Yeah, there's ideological blocks, even though they are represented by characters, because that's just the easy way to do the writing. And on the ground, Quinn Reinford, however you want to say his name, and the militia, and the Luzana aristocracy, and their militia, and the excavation team, which becomes its own block. They're like, the focus on coalitions and the focus on characters, you just can't get rid of them. Like, they represent a constituency and you need to work with them also helps, which I'm hoping is a transition to us talking about some of the characters.
Yeah. I'm not sure how Jeff would feels about this, but just to answer that semi-rhetorical question with an actual answer, like, in Gundam 79, I think you could make an argument, like, there's definitely personal factions within the Zeon, but equally you have within it a ideological split between those who are quote-unquote committed to the ideals of Zeon, that, like, humanity will go out into space and will evolve into something greater than it was in Earth, and as you say, like what Tomino was saying, space, you're going out in space and that's where humanity will find its destiny, and those who are just like, now we've got to grab what's ours, the people who basically overthrew the originator of those ideas and basically thought, oh yeah, this is an interesting idea I can use to govern my militaristic space empire with. And I don't really feel like there's a coherent ideology behind the Earth factions within 79, Jeff.
Yeah, the 79 is, I think, the most clear cut. Like, the Earth faction is just, they're the good guys. They, you know, they're always on the back foot. They're always the one being attacked. There's very little concept of there being like two equal forces in conflict. There is Zeon, who is waging war on everybody else, and sort of self-consciously descending into like authoritarian fascism. And you have the Earth forces with Amuro's Gundam. They're the Rebel Alliance from Star Wars. You know, they are theoretically a pluralistic collection of different factions all fighting together against the one big threat, but there's never really any tension or conflict that would make you wonder, are they the good guys? Are they the bad guys? You have Char, who is kind of just out for himself, and that is what brings him into conflict with Zeon. It's not any kind of ideological split where he is aligned with them in some ways. It's mostly just him playing them so that he can get his revenge. Yeah. Things are, like Ben was saying, like, very personalized, very internalized. The sides of the conflict they're on more or less paint whether or not they are a villain in the eyes of the show, regardless of, like,
with
who
Char,
they
kind of post hoc whack on the idea that he's the heir to Zeon's legacy because he is his literal heir, and the Zabbies had just usurped him. But all we get as his motivation is the usurping. It's not the ideology, although he in turn is seen as like one of the two people most an example of an evolved human who is completely wasting that potential in the most violent and egocentric way possible. It's an angel dragged down by petty vengeance.
Mm-hmm. Falling angel, the rising ape, that sort of that dichotomy, yeah. Mm. I have to say, I'm as much as I like new types as a concept floating around in Gundam, I'm glad that it's very implicit. There's clearly like a new class of person being created by the conflict of Turn A Gundam. There are individuals who rise, Loran especially, Harry, Deanna and Kiel, even Sochi and Miche, these star pilots who seem to be above it all. There's not this kind of progressivist ideology. It's a return to the past.
Retfern Gundam.
Yeah. But with the turn A for the V.
I'm sure that won't break anybody's like.
Yeah, I'm excited. Everyone's RSS feed's going to just go shit. But yeah, so now that we've talked about it, because I made the comment in the chat that I think a lot of why the characters are good is because of these splittings that Tomino had these characters as buckets for a lot of ideas, and Char, he just, you know, poured an incredible amount of stuff into the point that the guy just kind of reappears in every series, either as himself or as a clear homage. But in Turn A, like, it's kind of split between, you know, the kind of like parvenu climber seeking power in Gwen Reinford and the kind of noble enemy knight in Harry Ord, the inimitable Harry Ord. And yeah, I don't know. What characters really vibed with y'all?
I think you know who my favorite is Ben.
Suddenly.
It was just there all along, and then it was just like, yeah. Before we go to that, I would like to say that in a weird way, the Char characters actually are split into three. As you're saying, you have Green, you have Harry, but arguably you also have Corin Nanda, who is the red mech piloting ace. And
crazy red mech piloting ace.
Absolutely crazy.
He hates the Gundam so bad.
Absolutely hates Gundam. The Gundam did something bad to him, and like that is
according to the internet, Corin Nanda is a refugee from Gundam Wing, apparently.
Interesting.
Based on like the brief flashes we get. I don't know anything about Gundam Wing, except it's some people's favorite and some people's least favorite. So
I think that's mostly, was it the first one you watched? And if you were in a North American, probably yes.
Yeah.
That was the first Gundam I ever saw.
It was very strange that he sort of like, is built up as like the last sort of survivor of the old war, the war which ended the world. And then he just gets murked randomly towards the end.
It's a sad death.
Yeah. It's like everyone else gets, when something gets blown up, they sort of like they can kind of survive it, whereas he just gets like his thing winged and it just goes boom.
Yeah, just killed. Yeah. Well, they have that a couple times in the show of just like if you hit the power plant, like the whole Gundam's gone instantly, and that kind of goes back to Jeff's like jury-rigged, not fully understood technology, which finds its greatest expression in like them finding nukes and being like, guys, these are not cool bombs. These are the bad bombs. And there's like, there's no such thing as bad bombs and all that mess. Yeah. There is something about like, this is a Gundam that very much desires to move past Gundam. And like the whole Turn A is summation of what came before, is its mathematical symbol. And we haven't talked about the OPs or EDs, but I know that you don't like, maybe now that you've watched the whole show, Duncan, you like the first OP. I love the first OP. It's so fugly and strange.
It's better than the second.
Yeah, well, Century Color. We don't even talk about Millennium Color, Century Color.
Jeff has still got that wonderful thing to come.
It's okay, because you endure it for 10 episodes, and then you get Moon, which is the better ED, which doesn't have a flying naked Loran. We need to talk about the quasi-sexualization of Loran too.
Instead, it's got a flying butterfly, Diana.
No, it's the most beautiful ED ever made, Duncan. How dare you?
It can be both the most beautiful ED ever made and have a giant flying...
I cry every time I watch that ED. I'm a big sap for... I mean, I cry at least once per turn in a Gundam episode. I don't know. The Yoko Kanno soundtrack, we'll talk about that. Just the sincere, nice people. Tomino often struggles to write nice people, and these people are nice. Anyway, Turn A Gundam's first OP, like, we have a bunch of images of earlier Gundams, and they fling them into a fucking black hole. They're dead. They are no longer in existence, and the black hole turns into a raging sun. Like, that's the imagery. And I do think that, like, it is why I make peace with Corin Nander's kind of sudden cruel death, because like the idea is like we can't like the we need to know the dark history, the black history, the redacted history, but we like have to move past it, and we cannot have any of it in our culture. We have to make something new because the previous world order made us destroy the world. They made us create brain powered, so we need to have a new idea of social, intellectual, philosophical order. Now can we talk about characters?
They make a really smart decision in that they introduce Loran, Fran, and I forget the third of the...
Keith,
yeah.
Anime's favorite English name, Keith.
as these... I'm not sure infiltrators is quite the right word, but definitely like scout for Diana Counter, the sort of militia pioneer force coming down from the moon. And they're there integrating themselves into a society. And that's useful because we don't know what to expect from this society. And so we've got three people to do that part for us, to go in as blank slates, to see what this world has and to react to it. We end up with Loran and him... becoming a servant of the Haim family and sort of working around the mines, and his relationship with Kiel Haim and Soshi Haim. Mm-hmm. As you say, this idea of that there are relationships based on like values and ideals, and there are things like that Kiel and Soshi are miss, and he is the servant, and there's mm-hmm. a way he has to address them. And this is notably not a democratic society. This is a sort of weird semi-feudal one almost, with lords and ladies and little fiefdoms across the Americas. Those sort of artificial are the start point, and then down comes this new order from the moon, which is more powerful than any of those ideas or institutions, and it almost wipes the slate clean, and everyone has to reconfigure who's important, who is a leader now, who is a pilot now, what was your old identity, what's the new one you're going to build. And the way that Kiel and Soshi and Loran's relationships to each other diverge, I think, is a really strong central trio. And obviously that becomes like a, not sure what you would call it with four, but four when you add Diana, and five when you sort of wedge Harry Ord in there as well. In terms of viewers, I think like the our perspective characters, it tends to be Loran and Kiel Haim, with Diana's made approachable by being forced to be Kiel, and we're allowed to understand the pressures on Diana by putting a relatively ordinary person in her place, and to see how trying to live up to those ideals, that role has basically absolutely weighed on her for however many centuries.
When they meet up finally in the mid-20s, after being separated for over 24 episodes, now watching it this time, the number of times that Kiel as Diana says, like, where's Kiel? Find Kiel. Need to, Carrie, go find Kiel, bring her back. Where's Kiel? And meanwhile, Deanna's just like, wonder how Kiel's doing. But when they meet back together and Kiel admits that she's read her diaries, and Deanna immediately is just like, oh, of course you did. And Kiel says, how terrible to live for so long. Like, what an awful fate to be the immortal queen of the moon. And Deanna has to kind of a little bit patronizingly be like, there are good things too. I didn't write about those, but I promise they're there. It's this beautiful, like, the idea that these women have such a profound understanding and sympathy that they're not, they don't just have the same face or the same voice. They ultimately have the same heart. Deanna gets validation for how profoundly lonely she's been as Queen of the Moon. And Kiel gets to find out that her life was the life that she thought was going to be her, like, going to college and then marrying someone who could take over the mine when her father died before he died prematurely in the war. Like, she finds out that she had this quite beautiful life full of potential, that she was surrounded by good people who could support her. They kind of, like, are able to see more of what's around them thanks to each other. It's, again, that like, the dyad. A word ruined by The Last Jedi, but we won't get into it. But the idea of these two as one and one as two is so well deployed to deepen these characters and to, like, allow them to experience this vast range of emotion and experience while it have in kind of they both experience it by on their own and through each other. As opposed to the characters who are very lonely, like Sochi, her little sister, who is just desperate for this conflict to give her meaning and to give her, like, love and attention and validation that as the younger sister, she clearly hasn't gotten her fill of.
Yeah. She, like, there's definitely a sense that her early self-identity is sort of built in opposition to Kiel, who has, like, strong favored child vibe because she doesn't have that attention. She sort of values independence and strength and sort of, like, a lot of masculine coded values, which notably Lauren doesn't seem to have. And that, along with the fact that he is her servant, mean that she's very dismissive of him initially because she just doesn't see the worth in him. She doesn't see anything that she wants to become. She doesn't want to be someone who's told what to do. She wants to have the choice to do what she wants. And
she doesn't want to be thoughtful.
Yeah.
For Sochi, like, the idea of waiting and thinking and seeing what happens is anathema to her, and she never stops railing against it.
Yeah. Yeah. And she's really possessive of Lauren in these early episodes as well. Like, she's jealous of Fran initially, then she's jealous of her sister, and then it's like she gets so annoyed at people taking him away. And I think, like, there's a sense that she sees this as a weakness in him, that he allows himself to be bossed around and manipulated. And I think there's a little bit of self-hatred in there because she doesn't want, that's what she's felt sort of constricted by most of her life anyway, by being told, this is your role, this is what you have to be. And when she sees Lauren told, okay, you are the pilot of the Gundam now, you need to play this role, she gets really annoyed with him because he's just doing what people are telling him. And obviously she projects this onto him rather than examining that it could come from her. And it takes us a good halfway through this series, slightly past the point we're gonna mostly cover today, to actually get past this. And I think she eventually does, not fully, because
has some events happen to her that force her to moderate her position or at least reconsider it slightly.
I think Sochi's arc basically is one that ends at the point where someone else sees worth in her and she's able to accept that. And I think that's moment where she's actually stops being so hung up on herself, she's able to actually accept others. And I think that's a really nice little arc for her.
Yeah.
She's still her tomboyish self throughout, but that's a plus, not a minus, Ben. Plus, not a minus.
Sochi is brat. It's true. There's a very early conversation where she's like, isn't Lauren just awful? And Miche, who is one of my favorite designs, as well as just, like, kind of a chill, nice, like, Sochi's normal friend, she's just like, oh, no. Lauren seems nice and reliable, and so she's like, but he's so annoying and he sucks. And she's like, okay.
Yeah.
The lack of self-consciousness with Sochi, the last few episodes before the midpoint break that we decided on have her falling in love with a, like, hotshot pilot from Luzana. And it just, it's so sad to watch one of what she probably sees as, like, 100 gestures to Lauren to, like, reach out and take her hand, and he just doesn't see her that way, and never even to the end, never fully sees her that way. He like what happens in their final exchange is because he will always be her servant, and so he will fulfill her wishes to the best of his ability. We can talk about that later, Duncan. But just. There's so much where she says, like, well, Lauren's on patrol because he's depressed that Keith told him that he's a murderer, which is not fair. Lauren really tries not to kill people in this show and never really has the stargaze stampede like comeuppance for his pacifism, which, speaking of comforting, nice things to see. And Lauren's like, I'm on patrol now, Sochi. Which Sochi's always yelling at Lauren to go on patrol and to go on the front line. And then he's on patrol and she wants to be like, hey, Lauren, would you be sad if I got married? And he blows her off. And when he comes back, she's like, well, he blew me off, so that was my answer. And it's just like, Sochi, be nicer to yourself and be nicer to everyone around you. You don't have to be this, like, angry and impulsive and pushy. And I'm glad that it's never punished, except through proxy, through bad things that happen to Sochi because of the people she associates herself. But she just can't. She wants it, and she can't get it, and she doesn't understand why the world works that way. And I appreciate that there are no hard lessons for Sochi besides the lessons that everyone learns in life. That's a kind of restraint that I don't often see.
As you were saying, the character work in Turn A is fantastic. The thematic tones that everybody is able to take are, you know, some of the best that Tomino ever does. Tomino also likes to have just weird off-the-cuff humor, and the two, like, Team Rocket-ass high-agency minions looking for a boss who just kind of haunt the entire show, Bruno and Jakob, are, I think, every time they're on screen, I'm like, oh, hell yeah, I'm glad these guys are back, because they're just, like, two absolute shitheads who just bounce from side to side. They come onto the scene with Corin, who is himself kind of a oddball comedy character who
just says random shit that doesn't make sense, and that's the joke.
He's the only guy who realizes that the white doll is a Gundam and acts upon it, whereas they are just kind of along for the ride. When Corin is taken out of the picture, they just kind of wander the earth and come across the main cast repeatedly. And their first thought is always, okay, how are we going to work this angle? How are we going to, like, work our way back into the good graces of the Diana counter? Can't do that anymore. Okay, so how about we try to assassinate Diana, and then the other faction will like us? Oh, no, we fucked that up.
Yeah.
Okay, so how about we take over the Gallop? Okay, we've taken it over effectively. We now drive it everywhere, but now we just get bossed around by Lauren until Corin shows up again. And they're like, well, I guess we work for this guy again.
Yeah.
I think Tomino must have distinctly patronizing opinions of, like, just the common man, because they're definitely,
I mean, they're definitely, they have afros everyman. And freckles and snaggle and, like, a huge overbite.
Yeah.
And the one guy's got, like, they wear these clothes for the entire show. And one guy's got a hat with no crown on it, so he's, like, burning his bald spot every second. But, like,
I will say in praise of Bruno and Jakob, they are essentially red shirts who survive a 50-episode series, and therefore their philosophy has great virtues. I would say
they get like a legitimately explicitly happy ending where they're just, like, entertaining children in the final.
Yeah.
But I often call them the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of Turn A, but infamously Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. So they're more like the R2-D2 and C-3PO or whatever the Hidden Fortress peasants that George Lucas stole. But I do think it's very funny because you skipped over one thing, Jeff, which is that between them falling back in and trying to, like, take over the Gallop, they do get conscripted as farmhands to a grumpy granny for an episode, and I think it's Jakob who's like, I hate this, and Bruno's like, we're getting fed, bro, like, it's so fine. Like,
yeah,
it, And I don't know, the kind of very Yamada from Blue Blaze is they're very meal ticket driven. Yeah. And it's very fun that all these other characters have these high minded ideals. Like another Striver is Gwyn Reinford, who, even though we never really meet his father, who's one of the territorial lords, which I believe is using the language that we use in the Sengoku Jidai for like local daimyo, like this is a fractured country waiting to be unified. And I think they use that language to kind of imply that we should expect the moon race to be this unifier, but then it just causes shit to go. But Gwyn starting out like using radio technology to talk with the moon, and he keeps trying to position himself as the head negotiator, but it keeps getting thrown off track because people just can't stop using these negotiations as assassination opportunities. The number of assassinations Deanna survives, like I think like 5 different times people try to assassinate her or Kiel as her. And Gwyn just keeps – he just pivots. Man, until the very last – until the epilogue, man has never stopped pivoting to the next big scheme. And like that is like kind of the dark, like problematic, powerful side of what Bruno and Jakob are doing, of just kind of bouncing around this world trying to find their meal ticket. And Gwyn is always trying to find the thing that will make him the most powerful man on the continent.
So, and this is like coming from a spot of ignorance, but I'm really interested to see what happens with Keith, because between all of the ideological jousting and worrying about the past, you've got this baker who is sort of quietly creating the liberal world order through like commerce and baked goods. And when, like you were saying, when they come across the town in the Sunbelt, there are moon race people and earthers hanging out together completely fine. Like there's no tension whatsoever. You know, the moon race are creating floats to float in the parade. They happen to make a white doll, and that's what sort of sets off the conflict of the episode, because Corrin happens to be in the town, and that sort of sends him into a psychological episode. But the fact that Keith was the one who brought them together, and he has sort of, from the very beginning, he will jump the fences and your early moon race bases so he could sell them bread. You know, his only real goal has been to keep this bakery going so that he can be a worthy husband to the earth woman wife that he has taken. He else is kind of ignoring. And I'm really wondering if there is going to be some big problem that comes up with, or if that is just kind of like the anti-ideology that Bruno and Yakov also kind of float around in, where, you know, that's just kind of the water that Tomino's brain swims in, where like that's just naturally unproblematic.
I think I do like Keith a lot. I like all of the original three, because like Frandall has this whole plot too, where she's a photographer for newspapers, and she deals with this deep crisis of faith when she finds out that they're just buying her photos to take them off the market, and like no one's publishing like actual journalism. It's all propaganda being run by the Lord of Luzana. And then Lauren, who very much like says, I'm an earther, like I'm from the moon, but I'm an earther now. Like I'm a citizen of vicinity. I went through the rite. Like all these people go native in different ways and kind of deal with the pressure there. But Keith, especially, there's this idea that like it's the technology that drives us to use it. It's never completely pursued, I think, as an explicit theme, but this idea that if we dig up robots, we'll want to use the robots, and we can use them for peaceful methods. Like we have the moon race using their robots to like help this harvest festival go on, but we're probably going to want to use them to kill people and take their stuff. And Corrin seems to be an especially important part of that in his like second life as a wandering mad monk, because he's a pretty cool guy until he sees the Gundam again, and that just like brings back his insane murderous asshole side. And again, this idea that we need to kill Gundam, which
Yeah.
We didn't. Like, we did. Like, you can't stop a franchise, and I don't really fault them for that. But
it was great that they decided that Corin has to kill the Gundam. Otherwise, yes. He's not going to stop. And so they let him kill he picks up the float and puts it in front of the Gundam. It's just, like, holding it. And he's like, I cut off your head. And he's like, yeah, you cut off my head, bro. Don't worry.
No, it's this ancient machine that oppresses immigrants is what it's phrased as.
Yeah.
And, like, there is only an inevitable path to discovering the Gundam's history, and history is didactic in both senses. It's a warning against what could happen, and it's a sign of what you can do. And you haven't gotten there, Jeff, but when the true nature of the Turn A is revealed, it begins to feel almost inevitable in the show that it will be used for that purpose. And this kind of terror at the nature of tools is to be used, like the idea that a tool languishes on a shelf or is used for some superfluous purpose is kind of unnatural. But at the same time, like, the ultimate purpose of any tool is to kill. Is, I feel like, almost the message there, and that tension and that terror of that we are inevitably forced by history and our own libido to create murders. And and Turn A really struggles against that. And that's why I like how Lauren, who, again, Lauren is such a fluid character, not just in identity and name and function, but it's so important that the one thing that is static about Lauren is that killing is wrong, and he will not be a soldier or an instrument of oppressive power. And being told by Keith that he is that, even unjustly, like, he spins out for like 24 hours straight where he just can't handle being like, you know, that cool robot with the laser swords and the laser cannon and the shield and the fly, like it's a murder weapon, and you're a murderer just for using it, whether or not you killed anybody, mm-hmm. because you inspire people, you inspire poor naive Sochi. Mm-hmm. To like be a killer.
One of the things which is I find interesting is that even the bad characters are still interesting. And I say bad, I mean they're just,
there are no like evil zabby perverts in this, thankfully.
Yeah.
There's definitely people within the fandom who have affection towards different Zavies, and although some more than others, but within this, I think my favorite turnaround was Lee Bojano, the Ojo-sama, who, when we first introduced to her, is just like this she's just a petty bitch. Like, she is just 100% here to flaunt her station and to put other people down. Like, she's, well, I'm the lady, and he's the most eligible bachelor, so he shall be mine. And slowly over time, she sort of like comes into her own and sort of finds that she doesn't really need him. For even just like a heel to have an arc to them is always quite fun. I would say there were two characters who I very much did not have that. One's Will Game, who was just absolute idiot, who I'm glad he got killed in about two episodes.
I'm going to prove my ancestor wasn't a fool by being a fool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But perhaps more glaringly, Poe. Oh dear, poor, like,
crybaby Poe.
I like Poe.
I like Poe a lot too.
What a name for an episode! Like, everyone else gets like Sochi's War, Diana Returns, Crybaby Poe. Just dunking on your own character there, Tom. You know.
Hey, I've watched this show with women, and they say Poe is very relatable for just being hot-headed and then being like, her increasingly crying bitterly as she like continues to ram up against her own limitations because, I don't know, she's the tool of a kind of uninspired would-be Caesar in Phil Ackman. Such a Silicon Valley-ass name. But, No, like, there are people who, like, monomaniacal people are punished in this show. And you have to be flexible, and you have to, like, be willing to change with the times. That's one thing that Pyramid Inus touches upon, and there's like a good conversation in the comments of that YouTube video of just that Gwyn is very stuck being like this kind of predatory industrialist, even after it's clear that like there's bounty in the mountains to build any kind of society, and we don't need to have this kind of like dominant top-down thing. Yeah, like the monomaniacal desire of Poe and her willingness to be used as a tool is definitely a character flaw, but like her grief and bitterness that she just can't seem to win, that she's stuck being the antagonist and not even a particularly interesting one. Like, she's the poor man's Corin in some ways for how she challenges Loran and company.
Poe is definitely the person who, when you're in a multiplayer game and you sort of glance down, you see Poe is typing, and it'll go for a while. Like, she's definitely raging that the game is rigged, and like, think she was promised that things would work a certain way and they're not.
And she created that situation. She's the one who like blows up Nokus, the capital city, during the initial thing, because like they don't realize that their particle beams are more destructive in air than they are in vacuum, and so she just like glasses a quarter of the city, one of the biggest cities in Emeria, just by accident, and never really owns up to it. Like, she always thinks they're barbarians who should have stopped resisting. And the military in general, the Deanna Counter Volunteer Force, which is to be distinguished, especially later, from Gim Gingham's actual fleet, which are the hereditary soldiers. These are all volunteers, the people who are sick enough to want to like get in a robot to shoot the people who are on the lands that you're going to take from them on Earth. None of them have any vision, and they're effortlessly, but always temporarily outmaneuvered by Deanna and Harry. But then again, that happens because their head negotiator gets shot during the first negotiations by that one bearded guy who hides a crossbow up his sleeve and just is like, I don't care, kill me. My daughter died last night. I'm going to kill all of y'all. Any other faves, or should we move to themes, to art and music? Because this is a beautiful show in its aesthetic particulars.
The obvious thing is that I think... we're of a generation who all grew up on the teachings of Valve that every character needs to have a recognizable silhouette, and I think Ternay does a really good job of having very little same face, very little same thing. Like, it's a very distinguishable cast. It has very well, apart from obvious exceptions.
Yes. Well, but even they, like, Kiel's slightly more tanned than Deanna, mm-hmm. and her hair kind of separates out a little bit more. Until they're together, you can't tell them apart, which is just brilliant stuff.
But I did love when Kiel has returned home, and she's this is post what Jeff will have seen, but there's a scene later in the show, and it's not spoiler saying this, where Soshi and Kiel are showering together, and so she's like, oh, your hair always used to be so messy, and like Kiel's like, yeah, I found that Deanna has this hair product and it's really useful. And it's like, yeah, fair enough, yeah, you've discovered moon hair gel, it's and you can now have perfect ringlet. It's probably the best use of moon technology for a while. Harry Ord, I think, just in terms of his aesthetic, it kind of looks goofy at first, but I've come to love it.
No, it's a fit. It's for real. It's and especially when he goes incognito as a moon race engineer when they're digging up the Will game, and he puts on his Oxford checked sweater vest and he turns away. I'm doing what Andy does. He turns away to take off his glasses, and then it cuts, and he's turned the other direction, so you still can't see his. Like, you never see his unimpeded eyes in the show, because he's put on his like slightly like tinted glasses before he does. Mm-hmm. No, Harry is mood, and just the fact that like it's always dangerous to have like good people on both sides. Under a certain ideological framework, but the fact that Harry is truly the knight, and even towards the end when there's a little more of a romance subplot there, and he's just like, well, I love one woman, so I could never love you fully. Like, this idea of this like gallantry, and how that increasingly comes into contact with the Deanna Counter military forces, who are like, where were you? And he's like, oh, I was doing a secret mission. They're like, there are no secret missions. He's like, yes, there are. And that's that. What are you going to do? Arrest him? What are you going to do? Shoot me?
Another thing is that the mechs of Ternay are distinct from every other one.
Yeah, somewhat controversial, but the longer you stay with the show, I think the more you get into, like, it's almost like a visual equivalent of, like, when something has a really dumb name, but then you end up liking the thing, and so the name retroactively becomes good. Uh-huh. Like, similarly, the weird crotch cockpits and the, like, weird lanky style of the robots and, like, the wild scale difference between, like, the different forces, yeah, which is, like, somewhat unusual. Like, all of those things kind of come together just to make the show look so interesting and distinct that I am completely fine with it. I almost don't like the fact that they have the, like, sort of classic 79 Zaku show up as the Luzana forces. Totally unremarked upon. They look like the weird sort of old chunky designs as opposed to the weird
equally, like, weird
skinny designs of the new range. They just have such interesting lines and interesting angles, and even the fact that the white doll, the Turn A Gundam, has a mustache and everybody calls him the mustache, it just ends up looking cool and interesting, and I'm just completely fine with it within, like, four or five episodes. Whereas it's just, I can absolutely understand why longtime fans look askance at the aesthetic of the robots. And I believe they were sort of famously designed by somebody that was
completely, of Aliens and Blade Runner fame.
Yeah. Not a toy designer, you know, by trade. And it kind of shows, but at the same time, it looks great. It looks cool. I like it.
Retrofuturism, which was Sid Mead's style, is perfect for this Gundam.
Yeah. They look like 1960s pulp dime store science fiction novels.
I think that's a very good way of describing them.
I do like the scale. I do like how you have these tiny wads and carpools, the iconic big sphere robots that just become cannon fodder, not in the same way as in your typical Sunrise Mecha, but they're definitely, they have chest rockets and they have arm machine guns, and neither is really effective against Moon Race forces, but they're on the front lines just, I don't know, soaking up damage. But, like, their size compared to, like, the Wadoms, like, massive, they call them scarecrows on the Earth side, which just have a particle beam that the main limitation there is that it's so destructive that you can't use it without being ordered to use it. And so there is this, like, nice, I mean, you mentioned before, Jeff, the cobbled together nature. There's the whole thing where one of the Gallop's guns blows up early on, and they, for like five episodes, they just have like a tarp over it. And they're just like, we don't know how to fix this yet. And it's kind of revealed, like, oh, all the robots have like self-repairing capabilities.
Yeah.
But we don't really understand them. And we have spare parts that we try to use. We don't really understand those. They have to bring in, Mood Race engineers.
Yeah. And like the early tactics of the Capools, like, they have rockets, but they don't know about the propellant. So they just use them as hand grenades and spears and stuff like that. And, or they're using, you know, the Earth equivalent of like anti-aircraft guns as sidearms on the robots. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, their effectiveness is like significantly decreased. And, you know, or they're using them as essentially pack horses to carry around artillery pieces.
I do like the sort of indeterminate mix of eras across Emeras. One thing is that I quite like is that I think because we've lived in it the whole of our lives, this is not a global civilization. This is still, as Ben was saying, each lord within his domain, and you know what's going on in your neighbor's domain, but you don't necessarily know what's going on two domains away. And so the incident which ends this sort of arc we're mostly concerned with tonight, the detonation of a nuke, you don't get the sense, like, the first nuke which is detonated in our world, everyone knew about it within a day, and that changed everyone's world. No one knows about this nuke being detonated apart from the people who saw that happen. It changes those people, but it doesn't change the world.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it exists in a weird gray zone, because there's a comment early on that I got kind of annoyed with, that Miche's dad, I think his name is like Leterun, Keterun, Laterun, he says, like, I'm a third generation aircraft manufacturer. And I was like, oh, so you've been, so there's aircraft have been around for like 60 years. Cause like the idea that the moon race just happened to invade at the beginning of the second industrial revolution, where like oil and like advanced machinery and rudimentary electronics have just kicked off. And so we have these massive, we have them being able to construct rockets and being able to construct like high-tech explosives. It is very cool. But at some point, it's kind of held back by the creator's knowledge of the actual progress of the second industrial revolution. And I don't know, like, they do hire a lot of moon race engineers, and that is a nice little band-aid over the massive increase and stuff. But they never allow it to become that they're out-teching the moon, which I feel like a lesser show would, like, the scrappy Earthlings who are, you know, not static and infected with complacency like the moon are able to, like, create more powerful weapons. It's always a scrappy resistance that's using jury-rigged technology. Like, sometimes things work. People withdraw because they just can't afford to lose the materiel, which I think keeps it from being, like, the classic Gundam zipping between 30 Zaku and they all blow up in a very animationally efficient scene.
Yeah, you had mentioned that a very interesting aspect of the conflict of the show is how many of the skirmishes don't have a clear winner. They come together, they clash, destruction is wrought, and everybody has to run and lick their wounds.
Yeah, the fact that there's a ceasefire from like the first dozen episodes throughout most of the show, that like, and that it feels extremely like modern and prescient for like, oh, the ceasefire is still in effect. We've had five battles since the ceasefire was declared, but both sides contacted each other to reassure that the ceasefire was still effective. And like when Phil and Poe decide to attack the Will Game before it takes off, he's like, we'll just attack the ship, we won't be attacking the people, that's not breaking the ceasefire. And it's just like, oh man. Yeah, there's a lot of you can tell a good show because it grows more like wise and prescient with time, and it's just wild how like technology and power and justice and land and memory and how we choose to remember things and how that defines who owns an idea or a technology, how all those feel very active right now. And this kind of gray constant war between, you know, waking powers and declining powers. And
you said that you feel that the idea of land is one of the main themes, Ben. I was wondering, it's sort of connected to the sort of design of the world. Like, do you feel like, obviously, theoretically, it's America.
Yeah. And they literally use scans of American world maps in the background for Ameria, even though I think the official map is a little bit more twisted.
And initially I thought, oh yeah, they're going for the whole red coats versus the plucky Washington's militia. Every time I've read something about Washington, it's like, oh dear God, he's like, oh, give me a professionalized army, please, dear God, this militia keep disobeying me, they keep going off and shooting people when I haven't told them and running away when I haven't told them. And then I sort of to wonder is it sort of post-federal America, or is this like kind of Meiji Restoration Japan? I think Gwyn really feels like a Meiji oligarch. Everything you read about how the way they are like, okay, progress at all costs, we're just going to take this progress from outside, we're going to bring it to our country, and using them to kickstart your own culture to become an equal with that. Like, it really feels like Green's particular form of capitalism that he embodies is definitely that sort of oligarchical one, was so emblematic of the Meiji. You obviously having far better knowledge of history from you. So like, what do you think, there is a land he is basing as the start point for all this, or do you think it's just a land where this takes place?
I do think it is a melange, and I think that there is a specifically smart connection between a social or civilizational revolution and a literal military revolution, and the idea that if the Industrial Revolution happened during the American Revolution, I mean, that's kind of, as you said, what's happening in Japan is there's a like slow burning socio-political revolt at the same time that this society is rapidly modernizing. And often these are wars of external conquest. I'm thinking of the Prussian ascendancy of the 19th century, or indeed America fighting against England, which could have crushed it, except they just can't afford to pull any armies from any of their other many territories. And so it just kind of goes on for a decade, which, I don't know, I was at the bar and I was hearing two men talk about Ken Burns' American Revolution thing, his documentary, and one of them was like, I just didn't realize that the war was so long. I thought we just beat the British a few times and they left. And it's just like, no, it was like a long time. And we were not winning for a lot of it. But I do think it's most directly informed. You're right to pick out the Meiji. The way that it's the people from the moon landing in Inglesia, which is kind of Northeast Atlantic America, and they want to occupy the Sun Belt, which seems to be at least parts of the Deep South. They mentioned that Floria, which I assume is Florida, is like, we could just make with Floria on its own. And there's an interesting comment where they're like, oh, the Sun Belt's uninhabitable. There's too much sun there. It makes you sick. And that's never followed up. But I thought it was interesting for why there is unoccupied land in this world that seems to be very divided up. But they do kind of depict it as an internal struggle, because it's just the moon race forces are inside the territory and they have a truce. And there's an idea that they might move out. But once they've established these farms in Inglesia, they don't want to leave them. And there is talk of like, oh, we'll have two moon race colonies. We'll have one with this land we've seized from the now like crumbling warlord state of Inglesia, and one from the unoccupied Sun Belt. I think it's interesting that it's very historically flavored, but it's not really like, there's not a lot of one-to-one. There isn't a historical individual that Gwyn Reinford is, besides any kind of upwardly striving autocrat backed up by state-like resources. And even once he's pushed out of Inglesia after the destruction of Nokis and is kind of just owner of the Will game, kind of, and consort of Lily Borjano, daughter of the Lord of Lusana, who, it's very interesting that we never see the like the lords themselves proper. There's a lot of politics off screen that I think works very well, like the whole Gallia invasion that they don't really talk about. And yeah, I think we see Gwyn's dad once during a military parade that happens immediately before the moon race invasion.
See Lily's dad once making a phone call when his capital's being blown up.
Anyway, speaking of the themes, I do think that one of the most underrated, or perhaps perfectly rated, I'm not terribly conversant with the discourse about this show, is Yoko Kanno's soundtrack, which I've heard there's a like orchestral medley performance of that I just listen to while cleaning all the time, because this is a show that I think has a very old school kind of soundtrack, as in there are specific musical phrases and instrumentation associated with different characters, themes, and like dynamics that get repeated. The one that I always talk about is Moon, which eventually, or Tsuki no Mayu, which becomes the second OP, is kind of played whenever someone is talking about their desire for the moon race to like live peacefully on Earth and integrate. When Keith talks about baking bread for the first time, when Deanna talks about how she needs to go back to the moon to stop the like return as it's happening, because it's creating a war that she believes will destroy the very thing they're trying to get. When Lauren talks about how he's not a moon race, he's a citizen of vicinity for the first time, we have this like beautiful song that is about, you know, the moon being a cocoon for a new humanity. And so just kind of as it slowly emerges as the moon race anthem. We have plenty of other songs that are also just as much accompanying certain types of scenes and stuff. The one that both of you independently commented on is the kind of like noodling guitar song, that one is like kind of stalemate, tension, but also perhaps a truce, like waiting for stuff to happen. The amazing Memory of Army Boots that plays over every... I have watched every single next episode preview just to see what Lauren said about the wind, because he always is like, the wind blows death today, or something really corny. He's not known as a great thinker. He's more just an earnest little kid. But the like driving song, military march of the memory of Army Boots, it's a very rich soundtrack. And the way that these old shows, especially long-running shows, like train you to associate certain musical phrases or motifs with certain emotions, and then you kind of have this sensation where you see something happening, and then the music kicks in, you're like, oh, it's this kind of scene. Mm-hmm. I think that can often have this kind of multi-track appreciation of stuff that I think the soundtrack really supports. It's one of Yoko Kanno's best, because it's largely just a mid-century score with a full band, a full orchestra, that really directs your emotions without pushing and pulling. Like movies these days so often, yeah, just like they drop the music before the scene, so you know what kind of scene you're watching before it happens. And I think there's often more delayed kick in turn A, where like a fight's happening or bad shit's going to go down, which is kind of just the like concert string hit that often brings in scenes of high peril. It's just a beautiful show in general. I could talk about the art all day, but I assume I'll make a fool of myself more so than even music.
As you say, it does have a subtlety to its soundscape, which I think has been kind of lost in a lot of modern shows. This is still, despite all the highfalutin things we're saying about it, this is still an adventure action show. This is still Battle of the Week. And that kind of show now almost always has the fight is on music. Feel tense now. Feel this now. Feel that now.
It's like when Soichiro Sagasu reusing Decisive Battle from Evangelion in his Godzilla movie was, I think, the most egregious example of it. That boom, 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 boom. And you can always have a hype-up sound, but I feel like Turn A is generally not trying to get you hyped.
I feel that you were right, that sort of setting an ambience rather than demanding your attention.
Yeah, what it reminds me of, because around this time is also, Yoko Kanno's working for Sunrise a lot now, like she did Brain Powered before this, and there's a couple of really good songs there, but it doesn't hang together the same way. But we do get Cowboy Bebop, and that is an incredibly like integrated soundtrack full of different motifs and different moods, and it's doing the same thing. And like, I don't think Cowboy Bebop holds up. It's so episodic that it feels kind of old-fashioned to me now. But I will say that the soundtrack is just as killer as the day it was made. And this is between this and we have Standalone Complex in a couple of years. Yoko Kanno is on such a hot streak. Like, she deserves all the credit. it's something we don't get as much anymore. It's just something. Any sort of soundtrack that could be played as like a concert medley is kind of rare these days, because there's not usually that many different kinds of motifs and leitmotifs being played through. What'd you think about the art?
We sort of covered it in terms of the design, but I think in terms of like the color palette, I think could easily still have been quite garish. Like, everything is a bit less intense, but it doesn't feel dark and it doesn't feel dingy either. It has just sort of a normalcy to it, which I think is interesting, because I feel like there's a desire for things to be vivid in recent... Like, I think I don't like that I'm comparing stuff to modern things. Like, I no, it's just like I feel like there's a certain amount of false dichotomy between like, oh, before cell shaded, after cell shaded, and like.
But this is notable because this is the last fully hand painted Sunrise production, barring a couple of occasional CG effects. This is the end of an era. Like, they start moving to digipaint at least partially after this.
Well, that's true. That like they didn't know that. They don't know that this is the last time they're going to do it. It's something we retrospectively impose on them. To them, this is just the way that we work, and this is just what is natural. And like, maybe that's what's so good about it, and why I get so annoyed with shows like Trigun Stargaze. The medium becomes the message. Like, it's, oh, we're making a CG anime, not this is, we're just, we're making a show and this is what we're going to use and we're going to use it appropriately for each scene. Actually, you do say that this is the last cell only show, Ben, but we do get some very clunky spinning head of the turn A, and then
that's only in the eye catch.
I don't mind the head of the turn A, but the second eye catch. Every time I see that, I feel like it's someone's just selected the turn A on a fighting game. That's the vibe it gives me. It's like turns to the camera and flourishes its gun. It's like, you selected turn A.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, between that and the magic eye background on the title screens,
yeah,
which I love, honestly. There's a certain becomingness of like the very first infiltration. That's why I can't hate the spinning robot. Like, someone spent 3 days animating that and was just like unspeakably proud of it.
I think I've argued with you recently about when a show doesn't have the budget in nowadays, it will still generally look competent, but it will pan across stills just as much as they did back in the day. And I don't think this is too guilty of that. I think you'll get cycles reused, you'll get panning within scenes, but it's never a stationary thing. There's always someone or something animated within it.
There's a couple of instances. Like, I'm very lucky. The Right Stuff Blu-rays are amazing in that you can see cell layer shadow. They're high enough quality that you can see cell layer shadow. You can see digital zoom artifacts, and so you can know when they're compositing something that maybe wasn't intended, because there's like, it's three cells deep, so like Lauren has a massive drop shadow behind him, or there'll be robots running down a forest path and it'll be zoomed in, so you'll be like, this scene was 4 times as big as originally animated. Like, what happened to change that cut? And then in the teens especially, there's a lot of times where they cut to shots that obviously weren't intended to be used as they're being used, and there's ADR from someone who's off screen talking. And so I do think it is also, again, not to end of an era, this whole thing, although if there's any show that tempts you to see itself as a historical inflection point, it's Turn A. But they are so much better at covering up when, like, the cut they animated is not one they can use, and they zoom in on a specific spot and they dub lines from off screen, and then they reuse cuts from previous episodes to kind of cover it up. There is a little bit of like making do, but when they're firing on all cylinders and it's just this amazing matte painting, like I was thinking in one of the last episodes, 25 or 26, is when Harry, Deanna as Kiel, and Lauren have met up and they're just standing in a field of grain, like talking about like how this is the future of the moon race. And it's just shown as this just these waves of grain and these characters just done in this fine bone detail. Like, it's not, I'm not saying that it's better, but you can't really match just the like fineness and detail of just a really well like inked and painted still frame or moving. When you stumble upon this scene of extra care of Harry threshing while Deanna looks over him beneficently, or even when Wilgame notionally dies, we see his arms and Lauren's like, the arms are all that's there. And Sochi's like, what does that mean? It's like, Sochi, you've been shooting at people for episodes and episodes. But there's this scene of Deanna as Kiel foregrounded above the de-armed robot with its pilot that's only arms, and the moon is blood red above them. And there's just this compositional stuff that's just people at the height of their game. And that's the thing that I really appreciate about Gundam, and what makes me want to watch more Gundam, even though I feel very firmly that there is no better Gundam than Turn A Gundam, is that it encourages you to, like, these are people who've been gnawing on these assorted ideas for 20 years, and this is literally the summation of everything they've learned. And it makes you want to see, like, earlier works that built up this knowledge and kind of digest it. There's an interview that I wish I'd read more thoroughly about everyone trying to, like, work on stuff. And it's them working out the first scenario of Turn A Gundam, and a lot of it is people like, we did this in this past episode, in this past series, and I want to come back to that, and I want to do it better and prepare for it this time.
Yeah.
And not only is that present in the story, but it's present in the art. I think that there's a lot of incredible refinement, and I don't think there's a bad character design in there besides Will Game, but they kill him off, so.
Yeah, that episode number 27, let me just get the episode title, because it's actually a relevant one.
All the titles are good, but yes.
That episode where they are in the field is the start of episode 27, Midnight Sunrise,
mm-hmm.
where we actually get to the nukes being set off. Mm-hmm. Swords to plowshares is like a phrase which isn't really used that much anymore, but I think it's still sort of like roughly well known enough that people understand it. To have Lauren and Harry down to vests and cutting corn, and then to end the episode with the first nuke on this world in hundreds of years, and everyone just running from it in terror. That's art with a purpose, not just mm-hmm. art as a flourish. And you can make an argument that the more you bring automation into animation, the less purposeful it can become, just because it's so easy. It's so easy to think, okay, we can copy that frame. We can just, instead of thinking, okay, I've got to start again, where do I want this thing? And Turn A is a very purposefully animated show, and that's a really enjoyable thing in any age.
Yeah, no, I agree. Any closing comment? Any weird observations? Any perverted thought?
Weird observations. One thing that is, you were saying the Tomino on like frequently will sort of shunt the show into a kind of like weird non-space,
yeah,
so he can concentrate on the characters. The landscapes of Emeria are very interesting in that they are almost entirely vibes based, and weirdly, like it's almost like when you have like backlot Hollywood movies, yeah, where like no matter where you are on Earth, you look like you're in the hills of California. And it has that feeling of that sort of like Inaka non-universe that like Dragon Ball takes place in, or that like just any random anime where they go into the wilderness and there's like, you know, sheer mountain cliffs and dense foliage and buildings just kind of like propped up here and there like they were dropped from space.
Yeah.
Or like just giant inexplicable caverns that can safely accommodate 50-foot robots without any kind of problem with exposed lava, like magma veins and stuff. Like, just
that's Mountain Cycle, bro. That's how it
is. Yeah. And they stick with that. I think it's fun. I think it's great. The original 1979 Gundam was almost identical. In that series, they kind of get away with it by saying, oh, the surface of the Earth was destroyed in the initial days of the war, and which is why nothing looks like an actual location on Earth. I guess that's also true of this series, as we find out going further into the series. I don't want to call it like a disinterest in natural geography, but just the way it looks like a Gundam, no matter where it takes place on Earth, is always just kind of charming.
That's funny to me, because I mean, my brain is poisoned by brain powered, alternate title for this episode. But like that one is very much, it takes place off the coast of several Japanese cities until they finally just go out into the Pacific Ocean. So Tomino has to stop worrying about that. And there's this discomfort for collateral damage that I feel he or his writer's room made him turn around and face, where the destruction of Nokus and like Gwyn's utter disbelief that like, here's this city of this guy who's willing to negotiate with you, and you blow it up for no reason. And we head out into these rolling fields, which are notionally occupied by farmers. They're notionally getting fenced off, but we don't always see that unless it's on there. And there is this kind of the wilderness of the pristine Earth that this really wants to address. That, as you said, Inaka is a big force there. I think that one of the reasons, and I might be wrong, and maybe I'll be listening to this 5 years from now and be like, put this on the internet, but I think the reason that Tomino is drawn to space is because he has a dream of war without consequences. And the low-tech setting of Terne forces him to, like, cope with the consequences. And even when we go to the Sacktrager, even when we go to the moon, like, the reveal that, like, the moon is just a network of cities and canals under the surface. It looks like the normal moon, but like, it's teeming with life. Feels like working against that instinct, and I appreciate it a lot. But there is still, like, it's much easier to ask your background artist to draw, like, a beautiful sweeping landscape or the weird. Like, I noticed this time that the mountain cycles are these unnatural fingers of land pushed up, and like they're spiky. And from the very first episode, if you rewatch it, you can see that, like, off in the distance of Nokus is one of those like finger clusters of stuff. And I don't know.
I think the mountain cycles are like, as an image, are interesting because obviously beyond the scope of what the episodes Jeff will have seen, like, we do discover an example of what they probably are, of the remains of, like,
yeah, no, absolutely.
But at this stage, they are just these looming things which are mysterious and foreboding to the societies beneath them.
The Black History forbids you from investigating, and it's only really the shock of the moon race invasion that, like, leads people to start questioning the Black History. And we get a big reveal. It's fascinating at the end. This is just too vague to be spoilers, but at the end we find out what the Black History is, and the fact that it's exactly what we expected is feels kind of presaged in how, like, we've dug up so much of the mountain cycle. Like, we know what happened. Unambiguously, we know what happened. We know what the Black History is hiding from us. Weird things.
T-posing robots.
The fact that the flat's power is to vibrate, and they're like, oh no, there's missiles coming for us, and like the like ret team flats fly into the air and then just like vibrate violently.
I am going to say the thing that I annoyed you with in the chat and say that I do see some parallels in the notion of the dream of childlike, consequentless violence that is on display in a lot of Tomino's work is also, like, you know, it is kind of a Baki thing where you have, you know, this childlike notion of strength and violence, and that being complicated in interesting ways by the injection of more adult themes and more perspectives that aren't just aggressively masculine in a way that is like utterly chauvinistic.
I think Terne is fantastically uncomfortable with the masculine. I think I think Lauren having, this is the thing we haven't really talked about, but Lauren having a kind of pseudo trans identity and not really defending his gender, like, he's misgendered, and people are like, doesn't it bother you that Gwyn, like, your lord, the lord of your lord, calls you Laura? And he's like, it's just what he calls me, it doesn't mean anything. And that's wild because, like, again, I haven't watched 79, but like, Amuro, I think, becomes kind of a name, and the idea that late into the show Moonrace are like, I thought the mustache was flown by Laura, and Lauren's like, yeah, I'm Lauren, I'm not Laura. But at other times he's like, yes, that's the same thing, like, I have a feminine persona that comes out in circumstance, but it's me. You can't take away who I am by changing my gender is kind of a really fascinating parallel to the idea that Lauren is Moonrace, but he sees himself as an Earther. Like, I'm just going to quote Pyramid Inu's argument at the end that, like, all of our identity is circumstance. And that's a terrifying, exposing thing, that where we're born, who raises us, what the ideology of the age is, like, what we want to do with our lives. These are completely random things that shape our entire world, and we can see those as threatening. We can see those as a threat to our identity, or we can realize that it means we have total control over who we are. And Lauren fully is just becomes the man that the age need, and sometimes the woman that the age needs him to be. And that's just cool. I like it. I like Lauren a lot. It's easy to get frustrated at pacifist characters. Rurouni Kenshin is incredibly annoying in that way sometimes, but I feel that there's a bit of Lauren in a bit of Vash the Stampede from the original Trigun anime, where it's just like, if war can be stopped by one man saying no, then I have to be that man and I have to say no. And I really like that as the protagonist's perspective of the show. It's hard not to find Lauren incredibly brave, because you can tell that he does not like being a killer and he does not like being the one thing standing between moon race genocide of random earthers and a peaceful coexistence. But he's there, and he's always there, and he, until the very last moment when he's allowed his beautiful retirement, he's a fighter, and I like that. I don't know. It's rare to have a worthy protagonist in anime. I don't know. Is that a problem?
And also, I wonder how intentional it was, or if it's just a coincidence, but in Z Gundam, the second series, one of the sort of like, you know, Amuro stand-in boy protagonist is named Camille Bidon. And one of the very first things that happens in the series is that he starts a fight with a bunch of thugs from his high school because they say he has a girl's name and they're laughing at him for it. And it just like sets him off into a, like, you know, a red mist rage. And the, you know, that being, you know, oh, this is a natural thing that we use to demonstrate the quality of our, you know, hot-blooded hero, is so utterly reversed and subverted in Lauren. I wonder how intentional that was, or if that was just a complete coincidence.
Yeah. We keep talking about Tomino, but there's obviously like a writer's room of six or seven people who had experience working in Gundam. They had experience working on Dirty Pair. One of them goes on to make Planetes, which is another like excellent show about society and stuff. It's hard to know what was intentional and what was just a happy accident. But the idea that a lot of Tomino's fixations, a lot of Gundam's baggage finds like a uniquely relevant expression in the idea of the future trying to murder the past and having to find a compromise that looks like our present is good. You should watch this show.
Yep.
In terms of unhappy accidents, Lauren has a. You say, oh well, we're not sure that they about the themes, but Lauren seems to get his balls literally crushed for about every other episode for about the first 10, falling down and landing in the most unfortunate and painful possible way, and it's just like happens to him again and again and again. And I
was
like,
it was such a surprise to see Brain Powered also has crotch cockpits. But I do, the crotch cockpit is such an innovation. It's because you want to be able to blow off the top half of the robot and have the pilot still survive. I believe it's a purely functional decision.
I'm in the groin.
But yes, the fact that every single fight does not involve the robots kicking each other in the nuts is unrealistic, frankly, and it ruins the whole show for me. C minus. I don't have anything grand to say. I feel like I ended it on a very grand note, and then you brung up nut shots, and now we're in Idiocracy. And I have to say that like the symbolic castration of Lauren again and again and again, is that what Tomino thinks being a woman is like? It's just like the world's kicking you in the nuts nonstop, and that's why you have a vagina. Is that? I wonder. I can't.
And then eventually, obviously beyond the scope of this, we know that's a common thing of the Gundam designs is the core fighter, which is like the emergency eject where you can like fly a bit of the Gundam away. And obviously cockpit is in the cock area, and therefore the core fighter is just the crotch area, which flies off on
just
it.
The peen. Yeah.
He finally loses in a fight, and what happens? Well, his masculinity flies away. I'm not sure you can do it more blatant than that, so...
There is something to be pointed out in that the first weapon that the Turn A uses after it's revived is the Rocket Hammer. And there's the infamous thing, it's parodied in Fooly Cooly, of where Tomino said that this was a serious sci-fi and people should stop treating it as a children's robot show. And then he introduced the Rocket Hammer and people are like, this is completely ridiculous and stupid. And he's like, it's just a robot anime. Stop being so serious. That's the duality of Gundam. Male and female, serious and stupid, queen and miner's daughter, soft boy and brave woman.
Yeah. And brat.
Yeah.
Brat. So she is brat. Like
Soshi Summer.
There's
let's all have a Soshi Summer.
there's a specific scene where she runs up and she's like, something's going wrong. And people are like, oh, we're working on it. She's like, that's stupid. I'm going out in my robot. And it's just like, that's the Soji. And that would be a male character. And I feel like in other Gundams, but they just let Soji just she's not a great fighter, but she's kind of respected for being the one who's like, I'm getting in my robot. She's the Jane, Firefly's Jane.
I did really like that. The couple, which is the little orb robot, like is kind of looked down on by everyone to a certain extent. Like
it's a trash mod. Like,
yeah. And then there's an episode, which I'm not sure if it drops just outside the purvey of this, but there's an episode where they have to cross a large body of water, and she discovers, oh, actually the capel's really good in the ocean. It's an amphibious machine. This is my time to shine. This comes just after she's like dealt with all her trauma, and she immediately after gets an episode where she gets to be the star and to like and ends with her with probably the closest to an act of intimacy with her and Lauren, where little orb robot hugs the big white Gundam, and it's poor Soshi Hang.
I said in the chat, Lauren is associated with water. One of his motifs is back to the river, and he meets Soshi and Kyo in the river as he's drowning, and we find out that he grew up on the canals and the moon, and yeah, he's so of course when they're in water is when Sochi's able to get the closest to Loran, despite her stubbornness and deeply unpleasant personality.
How dare you!
and she also gets a redo, because in that first episode it's Kihale that rescues Loran out of the river while Soshi kind of flails about.
Yells at him for being stupid.
Yeah.
and his fish, his toy fish. We've talked this to death. I wouldn't mind watching the last 24 episodes and then talking it to death again. Maybe not as the next episode. We have to cover this season of anime, which, Duncan, you have not helped by talking about how Turn A Gundam is just dunking on Trigun Stargaze at every turn.
But it is. It does.
It is. It's a superior work about pacifism.
Deciding that I was behind on a few shows and I should catch up on them, this is not a show which makes the other shows you watch next to it come out particularly well.
So. Yeah. No, it's... we used to think about things. Return A. Yeah, so let's go ahead and call it there. Next episode, we will be talking about the end of the Winter Anime 2026 season.
And we'll be continuing to shit on Trigun Stargaze.
I'm going to try to be nice. Like, no, if I can not. If I didn't say a single bad thing about Turn A. I can say one good thing about Trigun Stargaze. I really can. I'll find it. I promise.
Hold you to that.
But I will not be a Soshi about Trigun Star.
Be a Soshi.
Be a Soshi. Yeah. Lauren sucks. He's hot and he doesn't like me. He sucks.
I mean, who can't relate to that?
Okay. Well, rate and subscribe to us on the podcast platform of your choice. Find us on Facebook, search for Keyframes Podcast. Find us on Blue Sky, Keyframes Pod. Email us questions, keyframespodcast@gmail.com. We've had a couple of comments on the website, keyframespodcast.com. We'll also probably be covering those in the next episode. We've got some excellent comments that don't deserve me to dash off something on my way to work. And most of all, tell a friend.
Not just any friend. Your gender fluid friend from the moon who sucks.
Your friend who is really into bread, he's really into bread. Like, he thinks bread will cause world peace. Tell him. Say goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.